Good evening, good evening, good evening, bonsoir. Je suis Rosie Goldstein, vice-principale à la recherche et aux relations internationales à l'Université McGill. L'Université McGill serait heureuse d'accueillir nos collègues, les membres du public et la communauté des étudiants et anciens étudiants de McGill à la conférence commémorative BD, un événement annuel très cher à l'Université McGill. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2015 Memorial BD Lecture. The BD Memorial Lecture dates back to 1952, when the university received a $100,000 gift from Dr. Henry BD. Dr. BD gave this generous donation to establish a public lecture series in honor of his brother, Sir Edward BD, who was the first Canadian-born president of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and a former McGill Chancellor and Chair of the McGill Board of Governors. The BD family has made a lasting impact at McGill. In addition to these lectures, a series of student scholarships is awarded in the name of Sir Edward. Many of you may be familiar with his former home, which is now known as BD Hall and houses the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders. From the beginning, the BD Memorial Lecture Series was intended to bring top thinkers, innovators, and leaders to McGill University in the service of advancing scholarship at McGill and in the broader Montreal community. And we are proud that the BD Memorial Lecture Series remains a forum for a multitude of voices and ideas that enrich the cultural and intellectual life of our university and our world. In its history, the BD Memorial Lecture has hosted a celebrated group of changemakers, including Muhammad Yunus, Queen Noor of Jordan, Deepak Chopra, and Arthur Ashe. That's why in 2015, the BD Committee began to associate the phrase, and I quote, change through exchange, with the BD Lecture, ou comme on dit en français, les vives voix de changement. I can't imagine a person who embodies these sentiments more than tonight's BD Memorial Lecturer, Dr. John Wood, a social change maker of the highest order. I'd like to now have you join me in welcoming McGill's 17th Principal and Vice Chancellor, Professor Suzanne Fortier, who will formally introduce our esteemed guest. Thank you.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à vous tous et merci d'être ici avec nous ce soir pour cette présentation qui, je suis certaine, va être très intéressante. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce and welcome back Dr. John Wood to deliver the 2014 BT Memorial Lecture. Dr. Wood is a graduate of the University of Colorado and Northwestern University. He teaches at Harvard Graduate School of Education and New York University Stein School of Business. But we have the great pleasure of claiming him as a McGillian because in the spring of 2014, we had the great, great pleasure of giving to him an honorary degree from our university. Dr. Wood is an inspiring philanthropist who created Room to Read, a not-for-profit organization that has won many awards and that has inspired many, many people. He's often spoken about his journey, a journey that took him from Microsoft executive team to social entrepreneurship. And I'm not sure if this is quite correct. You will, I'm sure, correct me if it isn't, but John took a leave from his corporate world, went to Nepal on a trek, and was inspired there by what he saw, and was inspired to help people reach their own goal of being literate. And so he became one of the best champions we have in promoting literacy and gender equality in education in the developing world. Room to Read was founded in 2000, and it is built on the philosophy that global change is facilitated through collaboration among communities and local governments. This is something that we certainly support at McGill, where we know that enhancing community partnerships is something that needs to be done and that our university is committed to do. Let me cite a few numbers in closing. Room to Read has opened over 1,900 schools and over 17,000 libraries in the developing world. It is reaching nearly 10 million students. And this is, I think, a figure that is very important because it represents the power of people working together and taking actions that can change the world. And of course, as the title of the lecture suggests, there remain many, many challenges. Despite these fantastic accomplishments, there remains many, many challenges in the global, in the battle for global literacy. And so we are delighted to welcome back John to our campus, and we're looking forward to hearing from him, and I'm sure we'll leave the room here inspired. Bienvenue, John.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. Bonsoir. I will start with my best je regrette que je ne parle pas français. So my remarks will, unfortunately, all be in English. And we are hopefully going to be able to raise the microphone a little bit there. So hopefully, can you hear me okay in the back? Great. Thank you. I stand before you tonight very honored to have been chosen to deliver such a prestigious lecture. And I really want to thank Dr. Carl Moore and Dr. Rosie Goldstein, for whom this was, I think this was their original vision to have me here tonight. If you don't enjoy my talk, please let them know. They're sitting right up here at the end. I also want to thank Dr. Anita Nowak, who is a close friend and was my original connection to Montreal, starting back in the days when she was doing her PhD thesis on emphatic action, and did a very effective job of stalking me and tracking me down so I could be one of her research subjects and be interviewed about that very subject. I was honored today to be able to record McGill. Is, for some groups, a MOOC is not enough, a massively online open course. They are doing a group massively online open course. That is being done by Dr. Nowak along with Henry Mintzberg. And this is one more way I've been excited to engage with the McGill community. Had you told me back in the day I was studying for my MBA at Kellogg that I'd be doing something with a legend like Dr. Mintzberg, I would have never have believed you. Finally, my thanks and my warm appreciation to the Beatty Committee, along with the staff of McGill, along with the incredible Montreal fundraising chapter of Room to Read, for everything that you do for our organization and for bringing me here. I was so honored to be chosen for an honorary PhD from the education school here, but I do wish to apologize to those of you who got your PhD the old-fashioned way. I am very sorry that I took shortcuts. But boy, no thesis, just a 10-minute speech. That was a very, very, very good deal. I say all of this to let you know that I feel like a part of the McGill community. In fact, in my hometown of Hong Kong, we're now having meetings with the alumni committee in Hong Kong, Singapore, and Tokyo to figure out how we can do more together. Because I feel like part of the McGill community and part of the McGill family, I've also decided to make my Beatty lecture a little bit provocative. I think when you're amongst friends, you can avoid kind of the kumbaya and the blah, 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 and really, you know, speak from the heart and be opinionated. And hopefully by being opinionated, you are also interesting. I'm not the kind of speaker who thinks I have all the answers, but I believe in the Socratic method of really asking questions and then basically stirring discussion. And hopefully some of the questions I ask tonight will be something that you discuss tonight over dinner or drinks or whatever you happen to be doing after the Beatty lecture. So I humbly and gratefully stand before you today with the intention of posing this deliberately provocative question, which is, whose version of the future is going to win? Whose version of the future is going to win? Why would I choose such a title for this lecture? Well, I choose it because this subject, because in today's world, we seem to be in a little bit of a state of chaos. It seems to me that the future is in play. And it's not clear which actors on the world stage today are going to see their version of the future be implemented. We need only review the day's all too depressing headlines to be reminded of these ongoing battles to define what the future is going to look like. Though as human beings, we all have so much in common, the visions for the future of the world's 7 billion people and growing are markedly different. Let's start with some of the more notorious groups, many of whom are making scary levels of progress towards their decidedly non-progressive goals, be it Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban, or ISIS, or Boko Haram in Nigeria. These groups have a very firm view of what they would like to see the future look like. And in many ways, it is a dystopian vision that is like something out of a George Orwell novel. Unfortunately, it's a bit like a George Orwell novel with beheading videos posted to YouTube. It's a place where the world is capriciously divided between the faithful and the infidel, with the penalties for being labeled an infidel including rape, torture, and death. In their vision of the future, women are treated as chattel or property. Their every move is controlled by men, and they are stripped of their most fundamental human rights. But it's not just girls and women who suffer. Boys and men do too. They are conscripted as soldiers. They are blown up by car bombs. And as you may have read in yesterday's New York Times, young boys are being used as sex toys by Afghan army commanders. And my own nation's government refused to condemn that because they thought it would get in the way. They thought basic human rights would get in the way of this fight. Children, both boys and girls around the world, do not receive an education. In today's world, over 200 million young people woke up and did not go to school. But in many places, children are taught a very virulent, very hate-filled curriculum that teaches them to divide the world into and then go after those who are different or are considered infidel. These groups are trying to create a world where their version of the future is the version that wins. And so the question I ask all of us tonight is very simple. What do we desire? Rule of law or rule of the gun? Do we want to see a world where all people are treated equally? Or do we want to have a world where the strong are allowed to prey on the weak? Do we want to live in a world where those who have power are using that power for social good? Or do we want to have a world where those who have power are using it to exploit others? Do we want to see young girls in school every day? Or do we want to see them sold or bartered into child marriages? Or worse yet, to be trafficked as sex slaves? Do we want a generation of educated and empowered women in positions of power like you have here at McGill? Or will we instead allow women to be subjected to often ancient, capricious, and misogynistic dogma? These, I admit, may sound like harsh choices, but I would argue that they are actually harsh reality. Every day these battles are being fought, and there are tens of millions of people who risk being casualties on that battlefield. Ignoring this fact will, unfortunately, not make it go away. There is no sticking our head in the sand on these issues. Now, you may feel this issue is too big and too complex for any of us to tackle. You may ask yourself, but what am I to do about something so big and seemingly intractable? I would posit that there is much we can do. We can support efforts by our governments to intervene. Perhaps that is military intervention. It will never make one popular to suggest that, but sometimes, as we've seen in human history, it is the only way. Or perhaps if you're more dovish, it is by supporting the appropriate application of development assistance so that the conditions that lead to poverty and hopelessness can ideally be eliminated. You can support organizations that are working to make sure every child receives a quality education. You can befriend a family who does not look like you, so that cultural understanding is enhanced across the globe. Whatever you do, do something. Because there exist very conflicting narratives of what the future is going to look like. And if you do not take the field, and if I do not take the field, and if my team does not take the field, and we are merely spectators, then we have no right to act surprised when the headlines remain negative day after day after day, ad infinitum, into the future. Allow me to move to a second issue that is also in the headlines, and I'm certain is also on many of your minds, as it is mine, the issue of immigration. Today, there are millions of people who desire to cross borders in search of a better life for themselves and for their families. Their reasons may vary. They may be trying to escape from civil war. They may be fleeing religious persecution. They may be trying to escape the lack of economic opportunities in their homeland. They may be trying to escape from a world where they don't get education for their children. We all know that in a world with so many problems, there are also many, many, many reasons for people to wish to emigrate. The places they come from vary dramatically, from Afghanistan to Eritrea, and from Syria to Zimbabwe. The migration is driven by a dream that tomorrow might be better than today, that people whose dreams have been thwarted by age-old problems mired in the past might escape and be able to instead be able to embrace a brighter future. I believe migration is optimism. Let me repeat that. I believe migration is optimism. It is all about people saying, I will not give up and I will not give in. I will not succumb to despair. I will not lay down and die. I will seek something better for my family. They could be forgiven for any of those utterances, for giving up, because their lives and situations are so challenging. To live in Syria today is to live in a place where there is no hope, and all you're trying to do is avoid the next barrel bomb, the next bunker bomb, whatever, the next car bomb, whatever people are throwing at you. But instead, these families are choosing to expend their meager savings, take daunting risks, and attempt, often against very long odds, to trod that difficult path to an uncertain, but maybe, maybe just possibly more positive future. This desire to cross borders in search of a better life for oneself and one's family is, of course, not a new story. Canada is a nation built on immigration. Most of you in this room and most of you who are watching on the first ever Beatty webcast tonight can remember that parent, grandparent, or great-grandparent who took that bold leap and delivered to their children and to every successive generation the opportunity to grow up here in Canada, one of the world's freest societies with one of the top five qualities of life in the world today. Congratulations, Canada, because your model inspires the world. While simultaneously, yeah, give yourself a round of applause for that. You know, when I lived in Beijing working for Microsoft in the late 1990s, there was a real lack of good bookstores. And I used to go skiing at Whistler, and I remember there was a beautiful Borders in downtown Vancouver. And you'd walk in, there was this beautiful photo montage showing the prairies and the mountains, and I think they had a picture of a Mountie, and it said in big letters, "The world needs more Canada." And I used to borrow that and say, "The world needs more room to read." But I love that, and I love the fact that I think it's an honor that people want to escape to our countries. My own nation, the United States, was built on a very powerful notion. If you can picture, and I saw it yesterday afternoon while running along the Hudson River in New York, the Statue of Liberty, a gift from the people of France, which I like to always point out because France gets a bad rap in my country, but the Statue of Liberty, on whose tablets you can read the words, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." Your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. That is poetry. How many huddled masses are there right now? Perhaps in a bunker, perhaps in a bombed-out home, perhaps in a place devoid of hope and opportunity. How many huddled masses are there right now dreaming of a better life for themselves and their family? I'm not great at Latin, But one of my favorite Latin phrases, or at least I hope this is Latin, it could be Greek for all I know, is proudly emblazoned on the U.S. currency, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. I love that thought, and I hope we can always embrace it in my country. But unfortunately, as this migration occurs, there is a loud and too often mean-spirited debate that is going to determine whose version of the future will prevail on immigration. A battle rages currently to determine the fates of millions of people who are seeking a better life. And the question really is, will it be the version of the future envisioned by the door slammers, by those who say, sorry, pal, my family got in while the borders are open, but now you're too late. This is a different world. Will it be the version of craven politicians who view immigrant bashing as an easy and convenient way to gain votes? Looking at you, Donald Trump. I only wish that was funny. Or will the version of the future be similar to the one from which so many of us have benefited, that of an open, welcoming, and multi-ethnic society? Will our response to immigration be built with high walls topped with razor wire? Or will it be built using our idealism, our pragmatic optimism, and the best part of our humanity? Will we dare to activate what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature? There are two versions of the future on immigration, and I would argue that one vision embraces our collective heritage in Canada and the U.S. of nations built on immigration, nations full of open arms, and nations committed to assimilation. The second idea of immigration rejects this proud history. And if that version wins, then with it a key part of the proud heritage of a great nation, I believe, will die a little death. The third battleground, or the third thing I want to talk about with versions of the future that are going to win, and for those of you keeping score at home, there's only five versions, five sets I'm going to cover. But a third battleground for the future is best exemplified by this little device that many of us have, the iPhone. In this case, I think it's a 6. And yes, this product is so popular that even ex-Microsoft executives are absolutely attached to it and swear by it. Around the world today, in Canada today, in the U.S. and in Hong Kong where I live, we have unparalleled access to information in today's world. We are information rich. Information is available instantaneously at almost zero marginal cost, and we can access whatever we wish to access in terms of information. But we are the lucky ones. Around the world today, there are never-ending attacks on the rights of people's opportunities to freely express themselves. We have the luxury this evening of being here at one of the world's great universities, where free expression and a bold tradition of debate and inquiry go back to McGill's finding in 1821. And I'm going to take this opportunity right now to wish you early a happy 200-year anniversary. Just so that I'm on record as being the first person to say that. We should celebrate that tradition of debate and inquiry and respect for other ideas. Definitely celebrate it, but please never, ever, ever take it for granted. The attack on freedom of expression takes on many forms. For example, harassment, imprisonment, and torture of journalists. Journalists exist to tell us what's going on in the world, to keep a historical record, and to hold everybody to account to make sure we're not shirking our responsibilities to those who need us. But harassment, imprisonment, torture, and outright murder of journalists continues. 1,200 journalists have been killed since 1992. 742 of those were outright murders. And in 90% of cases, no perpetrators have been brought to justice. There is a tradition of leaving an empty chair at public events. I'm not sure who started it. I should probably be on Wikipedia figuring that out. But there is a tradition of leaving an empty chair. This empty chair here today is not for me to sit on. This empty chair represents every journalist who would like to cover an event like this or cover any event in the world, but who cannot because they're imprisoned, often being tortured. I'm going to quote from the World Association of Newspapers about what happens when journalists are harassed and imprisoned. They write, "A climate of self-censorship is the inevitable result of these appalling figures, a situation that severely undermines the independence of the press and the ability of journalists to investigate issues of accountability, transparency, and wrongdoing. The impact of this spiraling situation, common in so many parts of the world, means the public loses its best defense against corrupt governance. There are many, many forms of trying to oppress the free flow of information. My wife and I recently hiked for 8 days in northern Yunnan province of China, which we loved. But it really bothered me that I couldn't tweet out my photos of these beautiful mountains and these fantastic monks and pilgrims we were meeting along the way, because China does have the Great Firewall, and that's affecting 1.3 billion people. There are science deniers all over the world. In my country, America, has a lot of people, a lot of politicians especially, who want to deny science. I think denying science is another case of basically trying to limit free expression of the truth. So to encourage all of us, please, let's not forget this issue, because there is a version of the future that wins that is quite Orwellian, where information is repressed and suppressed, and your ability to know what's going on in the world will be under attack by journalists. It may not happen here, but it's happening in so many places, parts of the world, from Russia to Kazakhstan. So to help, number one, support quality journalism. Quality journalism requires us to pay money for it. I know there's an old adage that information wants to be free, but guess what? Journalists need to put food on the table, just like the rest of us. Or sponsor a scholarship for a deserving young student to come to Canada and learn from your society. Or the next time you're tempted to post a cute photo of your kid or your cat on social media, and trust me, I know the only thing cuter than your kid is your cat, but the next time you're tempted to do that, maybe instead post a photo of a detained journalist, so that the world does not forget them. Leave an empty seat at your next event and mention this to people. Make a new friend from another country and send them a few thought-provoking books or magazine articles and ask them to do the same for you. Or dare to express an opinion that may not be instantly and universally popular, because that's how the free exchange of information and debate occur, and hopefully it will be civil. My fourth version of the future question I want to ask is all about the future of capitalism. The specific question is, will capitalism be a force for good in the world, or will it be a system that focuses only on making rich people richer? There is no denying the power of the capitalistic model. Capitalism has created trillions of dollars of wealth, and as we've seen in places like China, Latin America, and some, but not enough, parts of India, it has the potential to lift millions of people, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people up out of poverty. Meanwhile, the communist model has largely been discredited. So capitalists can no longer rely on their previous time-worn bromide that at least capitalism is better than communism, because that's what they used to say in the 60s and 70s if you attack capitalism. But that is actually no longer a choice, because communism has been really in retreat pretty much everywhere. So I believe the new choice is between the old version of capitalism and a more enlightened version 2.0 of capitalism. The questions I ask us here tonight are as follows. Do we unleash the power of capitalism for the collective good and for a sense of purpose? Or will capitalism focus on nothing more than profits or of helping the rich get richer? Do we have capitalism with a conscience, or do we have capitalism without it? Well, I'm a glass half full optimist, and I've tried to live my life that way, despite the fact that this lecture can be a little bit of a Debbie Downer. Don't worry, I'm going to pick it up at the end. And I believe that just as human beings evolve and society evolves, it is my hope that capitalism will also evolve. When I was an MBA student at the Kellogg School at Northwestern, back in the late 1990s, Milton Friedman was required reading. When asked his view about what we today call CSR, or corporate social responsibility, Friedman famously opined, quote, "There is one and only one social responsibility of business, to use its resources and engage in activity designed to increase its profits." You can almost picture him slapping you on the back of the head and saying, "So get back to work and stop daydreaming about peace signs and unicorns, you damn hippie." You really cannot picture Milton Friedman saying that. But the point being, of course, that was accepted dogma for a long time. And the good thing is, and I'm privileged to talk at business schools, undergraduates, MBAs, education schools all over the world. And I believe that today's generation does not believe in that version of capitalism. And I don't believe that any of the young people I've met today believe that the only social purpose of a business is to increase its profits. I believe instead that purpose is the new competitive advantage, that companies are finding ways to build a sense of purpose into their DNA. We see that with the rise of B Corps and this week's news that Kickstarter has decided to become a B Corp. For those of you who don't know about B Corps, what they're doing is they're having a different way. The typical charter of a business requires the leadership to maximize profits. And if they don't maximize profits, they can be sued by shareholders. B Corps have turned that on their head. And a company can declare that while profitability is a goal, it is not the only goal. And they may maximize or optimize decisions for the social good. I would like to see more of that. I think more companies need to build purpose into their DNA because purpose is, in my mind, the new competitive advantage for companies. What do I mean by that? Well, let's look at it this way. Anybody who runs a business knows there's a constant war for talent. And if you want to recruit the most talented people to your company, you have to work pretty hard. Well, if you look at the younger generation today, they want to work for companies that have purpose built into their DNA. With no offense to coal companies, with no offense to ExxonMobil, most young people I meet as I travel would rather work for SolarCity, or they'd rather work for Tesla, or they'd rather work for a company that they feel has social good baked into their DNA. Purpose, I think, can also be used by companies to motivate and retain their employees. Because if you work for a winning team, and that winning team's putting up some good numbers on the profitability side, while simultaneously doing good things for the world, then what employee is going to want to leave that type of environment? Finally, a sense of purpose can be used to delight customers. And you only need to look at companies like Warby Parker to see how quickly people are now building businesses valued at $1 billion and over by baking purpose into their DNA. So my hope is that we will embrace another version 2.0, an evolving version of capitalism. The fifth and final thing I want to talk about for versions of the future is about this issue of income inequality. When we were filming this morning's group online open massive course, or GROOC, on social change, Dr. Nowak opened by pointing out to her students that 60% of the world's wealth is owned by 6% of its people. 60% of wealth owned by 6% of people. Thomas Piketty, of course, also wrote in his best-selling book, Capital in the 21st Century, about this issue of income inequality. It was a surprise bestseller. I would probably guess that a lot of copies of that book have the highlighting abruptly end at around page 57, kind of like Plato's Republic. You know, you kind of think you're really into it, and then at a certain point you just kind of give up and throw down the highlighter. But it was the right book at the right time, because more and more people are focusing on the widening inequality around the world today. One version of the future is that we accept the continued persistence of income inequality as being inevitable, as though it is the inevitable result of a capitalist system that we have embraced. Another version is to go attack it and say, let's take on income inequality in as many ways as we can. When you look at income inequality, we know that there are two ways to reduce it. One is to lower the income of the top earners, usually through either legislation or higher and often punitive taxes. The other way to reduce income inequality, and I would argue it's the better way, is to raise the incomes of those who are at the bottom, because that also reduces income inequality. Please allow me to offer you my own view on this. I am not a huge fan of approaches that penalize the rich. That may be surprising since I'm a do-gooder, but I'm not a fan of the idea of penalizing the rich, because once you do that, you're entering into a world of zero-sum games, and you create win-lose situations. We take from person A or person B to give to person C or person D. Person A probably resents that, and as a result of that, has less faith in the system. I, of course, believe the world needs a certain baseline level of taxation to create a robust social safety net, so I'm not arguing for artificially low taxes. But I think there is a better way than punitive levels of taxation. and that is to find ways to increase the incomes of those in the bottom quartile. In other words, rather than lowering the ceiling, we find ways to raise the floor. There are many ways to do that. Investment in education is a great one. Mentorship of people who need your mentorship is another. Microfinance or other means of access to capital. Entrepreneurship training so people can start and run their own businesses. Diverting your consumer dollars to socially responsible companies so that your dollars end up in places where they're doing more good for the world. Perhaps a local business that goes out of its way to hire people who need jobs or who need to be hired. You can probably think of a few more. But we can lower the ceiling or we can raise the floor. And I hope we do everything in our power to raise the floor so that those who are excluded are instead empowered to be better off financially. I will say that I think the mega rich need to step up their game. Some of the pain the mega rich are feeling is actually, I think, self-imposed. We need to see fewer photos of billionaires in helicopters and yachts and more of them actually rolling up their sleeves and doing something more constructive for the world. I think there are a few ways that this can happen. One thing is I've spoken out about foundations. The average foundation spends about 5% of its assets per year in grants. And I believe that number is way too low. I believe in the adage that Benjamin Franklin had that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Foundations pay out only 5% of their assets, while well-meaning and well-intentioned NGOs like Room to Read remain underfunded and not able to meet the demand we have to go build schools and libraries in the developing world and fund long-term scholarships for deserving young girls. Why only 5%? Because foundations often believe they should exist in perpetuity. But my challenge to them is very simple. If foundations exist in perpetuity, we should probably not be surprised if age-old problems also exist in perpetuity. Another area I'd like to see changed is with the Giving Pledge. I am a huge fan of what Bill and Melinda Gates, Melinda was my first boss at Microsoft, and they are a generous funder of Room to Read, have done with the Giving Pledge. I just have one problem with it. People are pledging to give away at least half their assets to worthy causes during their lifetime, comma, or at death. And I think in many cases, death may be too late. If somebody has a lot of money and they sign the Giving Pledge and they're 40 years old, and in this age of increasingly long lifespans, they live 50 more years, we have 50 more years of lost progress, 50 years that we could have been doing things that we were not doing them because the money simply sat in a bank account. So those are my thoughts, and I hope you enjoyed them, on income inequality. Let me close by talking about how all of us can be agents of change, and all of us can go make progress in helping to hopefully fight for whatever version of the future we would all like to see. Defining the future, or helping to define it with a group of others, is a wonderful opportunity for all of us. If we can all decide to take the playing field, we can help to assure that the version of the future that wins can be one of which we can all be proud and very, very happy to embrace. My own example of quitting Microsoft, building and co-leading a global movement called Room to Read, of which Canada has played a key part, has been one way that I've tried myself to be an agent of change. The good news is it's never been more possible to be an agent of change than it is in today's world. That device you have in your pocket offers you computing power that 50 years ago kings and queens and presidents did not have. It gives you instantaneous, free connections to billions of people. You have instant access to all of the world's knowledge. You can go to Montreal Airport tonight, get on a plane, and in one hop or two, you can be in your choice of thousands of cities in less than 24 hours. You have toolkits for fundraising like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And there are foundations like Draper Richards Kaplan, Skoll, Ashoka, Echoing Green, and others whose raison d'etre is to fund social entrepreneurs. Finally, and most importantly, we all have a network of people who believe in us and want to see us do great things as we invent the future, whether it be at the local, provincial, national, or international level. So I do hope all of us will make a pledge to be an agent of change or to be even more effective and more dedicated agent of change than we already are. Defining whose version of the future is going to win should ideally not be a spectator sport. I encourage all of us to take the field. Grab an issue that you care passionately about and go big, 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 huge on trying to solve it. Let me assure you that our team at Room to Read is walking the walk on this. When we started in 2000 as a small, cash-strapped, little garage startup NGO, we came up with what Jim Collins, the author, called a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. And our BHAG was to reach 10 million children in the developing world with a lifelong gift of education by 2020. We were told that was a crazy, hubristic goal for an unknown, cash-strapped NGO. But I've always believed that bold goals attract bold people. And many of you in this room are part of that bold coalition of people forming a global network called Room to Read. The good news, and I think proof that anybody can be a massive agent of change, because if I can do it, you can do it, is that Room to Read is going to reach our 10 millionth student by the end of 2015. The train arrives. Thank you. Thank you. The train arrives in the station 5 years early, which makes us so incredibly proud and so thankful to everybody who's been with us on this incredible journey. So we've raised our goal significantly. We've changed our 2020 big, hairy, audacious goal to 15 million children. We're going to add 5 million additional children to our short-term goal and try to reach 15 million. Longer term, our goal is even bigger. Quite simply, our global team wants to forever end the day that any child can be told you were born in the wrong place at the wrong time for the wrong family, and you therefore will not get educated, and you therefore will be one more generation to live in perpetual poverty. We believe that idea belongs on the scrap heap of human history. We believe that every child can be told and should be told you were born in the right place at the right time because Room to Read was there for you, McGill students and alumni were there for you, Canada was there for you, as were a global cadre of compassionate capitalists who decided to reinvent capitalism to do social good as well as produce profits. The version of the future that will win, I hope and pray, will be our vision of education for every child, not the vision of players like Boko Haram, ISIS, or Al-Qaeda. Defining whose version of the future is going to win should not be a spectator sport. I've said that once, but I'll say it again. It should not be a spectator sport. If it is, then we should not be surprised if we do not like the result we end up with, and if we don't want to live in the future that is created. So let's think big, let's execute flawlessly, let's proudly influence and own the future. Thank you, and good night. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. I'm gonna play that applause tape for all 1,000 plus Room to Read employees and all 13,000 volunteers because it is a team sport. But thank you. That is very touching reaction. And there is my good friend, Dr. Carl Moore.
All right. Thanks, John. Great job. We have about 10 minutes for questions now. There's four mics. If you have a question to ask John, please come up to find the mic and pose your question. Try to make it reasonably brief, as we only have 10 minutes. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, hi. It's not really a question. Thank you, Dr. Wood. Found what you said really inspiring. Thank you. I was just really
call me John, though, please.
Okay, John.
Thank
no
you.
No problems.
I'm a small town boy, and I didn't earn that PhD.
Okay. So look, what I wanted to say was this: is that I very much think globally, act locally. Right. I think you've heard that saying, right?
More than once.
Yeah, thank you. So what was going through my mind when you were talking about, ISIS and, you know, the horrible things that they're doing, which is terrible, of course. But there are things happening here in Canada which we need to talk about. And I think there's been this legacy at the moment with the Aboriginal women and the murdered and missing women here in Canada. And I think that, you know, that kind of, this violent kind of attitude violent racist sexist attitude towards Indigenous women here. It's not a question, it's just a comment that rather than looking out, we need to look here and see what's going on here too, you see?
If I could comment on that.
Please.
I think every organization has to figure out what its focus is. And you can't go to organization A that's doing great things on cancer research and say, yeah, you're doing great things on cancer research, but what about the lack of clean water? And right, organizations have to focus. What I would argue, and I've written two books to share my learnings with other social entrepreneurs, is I think that their need, like Mao said, let 100 flowers bloom, is that if that is an issue that has a need, then somebody in this room's got to grab that, and they've got to create something that's going to go after that and try to solve it and lead with the solution. The reality is, in a world of 7 billion people, there are so many problems to solve. What's great, though, we saw this morning in a social entrepreneurship class, is there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are saying, I want to go lead a movement to do thing X or thing Y or thing Z. So I guess what I'd say is, they're out there. Get online tonight. Go find the person attacking that issue. Email them, call them, and say, I am with you. I'm joining forces with you. And let's go after this, and let's go after it hard.
Hello, I have a question.
Where are you?
I'm up here.
Oh, hi. There you are.
Hi.
You're way in the back, and I think you're wearing black.
Or brown.
Brown, okay.
Okay, I really have a question about globalization. The most recent paradigm of globalization, which has quite a lot of distortion around it, and education today seem to have somehow lost connection. The globalization initially was meant to foster a trickle-down, more equality amongst the populations, and obviously education for the better for both adults and children in third world areas as well as first world areas. And has this happened in your impression, in your opinion, or not?
Specifically, has what happened?
Have you seen this spread, this trickle down, this improvement, apart from your specific?
Well, take the issue very briefly of education for women. Two-thirds of those who are out of school in the world today are girls and women, and two-thirds of those who are illiterate in today's world are girls and women. 98% of the illiterate people live in the developing world. So if you don't have a strategy for the developing world, you don't have a strategy for illiteracy. But what's been found is that for every year a girl or a woman goes to school, beyond the average, her eventual income increases by 15%. So if in a country where the average is 6th grade, if you can get a girl through 12th grade, her eventual income will double. That's one of the things that's picked literally tens of millions of families up out of poverty. What's also good about that is when a woman in the developing world makes more money, she tends to spend it on her family. Mm-hmm. She spends it on food, shelter, medicine, education. No offense to the men of my gender, but when men make more money, they tend to spend it. They're more likely to spend that money on themselves, and they're less likely to actually invest it in their family and their children. So if you can basically look at the economic opportunity that would be unlocked, if you could take the fact that over 120 million young women don't go to school today, get all 120 million of them through secondary school, it would affect every child they have, it would affect family economics, it would actually affect GDP in a very big way. So that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this issue. The Economist to me is passionate for that reason, but in my heart I also know that I got lucky because I had an educated mother and an educated grandmother, and they changed my life forever by making sure that I read from a young age. So I do think there's a lot of hope for the world if more and more women and girls can go to school and stay in school. And I think the economic statistics really bear that out. If you want good data on that, go to the Population Council's website.
So essentially you're saying that there isn't a flattened economy and globalization works?
There is what? Sorry?
There is not a flattened economy and globalization actually is working?
No, I think you're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm asking.
I think we should talk offline. I think globalization is way too complex to say it mm-hmm. works or it doesn't. There are certain aspects of it that work great. If you are a family that a generation ago was a peasant family on a small plot of land in southern China in the Pearl River Delta, and now you are middle income, you may argue that globalization works. But globalization, unfortunately, has its winners and has its losers. Mm-hmm. And it's so I'm sorry I can't give a better answer than that, but it's
that's complex. That's fine. Thank you.
Front row.
Hi there. Thank you so much for the talk. It was really inspiring. I have a question just going back to what you do and how you sort of got started in a world full of different issues that we're all confronted with, both locally and internationally. One of the big challenges is trying to decide what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what inspired you originally. I mean, you said a lot that your mother gave you space to read and that sort of thing. But what inspired you originally to take up this cause? And perhaps as an extension, was there ever a moment in the past 10 years that you found yourself exhausted, maybe disillusioned, and how did
more
you,
than one
and how did you overcome that without giving up?
So what originally inspired me, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wrote about it in my book Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, which is on sale outside the door, and we will be doing a book signing. But all kidding aside, when I was at Microsoft, I left in 1999 to go do a long trek in Nepal. I was fortunate enough during an 18-day trek to meet a headmaster who wanted to show me his school. The school, like many schools in the developing world, was simultaneously both hopeful and rather sad. Hopeful because 450 kids were coming to school every day, but very sad because they had ramshackle conditions, dirt floors, 80 kids crammed into a room, no desks. And when the headmaster showed me the library was completely devoid of any books for children. And I asked the headmaster, why? You have 450 students. And he said, well, in Nepal, we are too poor to afford education, but until we have education, we will always remain poor. And that struck me as a catch-22 because societies either pick themselves up or don't because of education. So when I talk about the lottery of life, that was the first time I saw it. Thankfully, like me, the headmaster was an action-oriented optimist. And he said, perhaps, sir, you will someday come back with books, which I grinned and smiled and shook his hand and said I would do. That was a sentence and a request that would forever change my life. That sentence cost me a lot of money as I switched my career. But I really inherently believe, as a kid who grew up as a public library kid, as a middle-class kid who had access to a public library, I thought, what would my life have been like if I hadn't had access to books? And so I need to do something about it. And it felt so good going back a year later that made me think this is a drop in the ocean when you have 773 million people who are illiterate. One library is not enough. 100 is not enough. 1,000 is not enough. And that's why I'm so happy that today we have 18,000 libraries serving 9.7 million children around the world. Because if those little people grow up reading, it's going to change their life forever. In terms of frustration, let me handle that one really quickly. Yes, it can be very frustrating to be a social entrepreneur. You have a lot of stuff you run into that's difficult, a lot of obstacles. You can have unreasonable funders. And because they control the purse strings, they can kind of yank you around if they want to. Thankfully, most of them don't, but a few of them do, and that's when you get frustrated. And I think for me, I just always try to think back to the students I've met and the parents I've met, whether I've been traveling in post-tsunami Sri Lanka or post-apartheid South Africa. Education means everything to these parents. I've met parents in 50 countries around the world, and I think parents are the same everywhere. They want their children to have a better education than they had, or they want their children to have a better life than they've had. And so that's what motivates me to keep going, is think about those little people. And I think I had a rough day because my flight was delayed by 3 hours. Big deal. I'm going to think about Tay T, the young girl in Vietnam who has to walk 6 kilometers each way to school and gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do her farm chores before going up. My life is easy compared to that. So I try to remind myself of that every day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We unfortunately have one time for one more question.
Okay.
I have a question to which there may not be an answer.
That's a great way to end.
But it's very existential. But I'd like to ask your opinion anyway. And that is, ever since time immemorial, despite the fact that we live in a world of vast riches, there has continued to be suffering and poverty. How do you explain that in today's world? Now, obviously, you are a living example of what can be done, but why isn't more happening? Because surely we know enough in this day of mass communications, if we didn't before, to see all the problems.
Yeah.
And we certainly have vast sums of wealth and imagination. So what is missing?
A couple things. Number one is lack of leadership. There just are not enough Mother Teresas and Nelson Mandelas and Wangari Maathais out there to lead us. That's why the social entrepreneurship program here at McGill and at any other school is so important, to get those idealistic young people and train them up. I think traditionally there has been a belief in a lot of parts of the world that governments exist to solve problems, and we can just basically pass the buck to the governments to say, well, it's the government's job to do that. I think what you see now with groups like Room to Read is we say we're going to work with the governments closely, but we're going to do it under a partnership model, public-private partnership. And so I'm optimistic, though, I will say. I think if you look at statistics, every year there are fewer poor people in the world. Every year there are fewer people dying of diseases that we should be combating. There's still a huge number of problems in the world, but I think if we can just kind of keep making steady progress, there are reasons for optimism. But I think one of my mentors always says, great people unlock all problems. We need more great people, and we need people to take the damn playing field. Because too many people are sitting on the sidelines.
You're certainly a prime example. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So I'd like to ask one of our MBA grads to come up and thank John. So David Rex Eagle.
Thank you, Professor Moore. I'd like to thank the Beattie Memorial Lecture Committee and the teams at Research and International Relations and University Advancement for their hard work and dedication on putting on tonight's lecture. I'd also like to thank the Days Hotel Faculty of Management for hosting Dr. Wood. It says Dr. Wood, but I guess John, and affording him opportunities to meet with McGill students and teaching staff during his stay with us. On behalf of the university, thank you, John, for this inspiring lecture. I think it was very timely. This seems to be, I think, very similar to some of the themes that Pope Francis was discussing today as well. So it seems to be something that's important for everybody. As a token of our appreciation for your lecture here today, McGill has made a donation of books to Room to Read. We felt this was the most fitting way to thank you and give back to the organization you have fostered. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's now my pleasure to thank John myself for, as everyone said, a very inspiring lecture, and I'm looking forward to hearing the follow-up from our students and from others in the future as they take your inspiration to heart, and I'm sure they will. And to thank you, je voudrais remercier mes collègues, la communauté des étudiants et anciens étudiants de McGill et tous les membres du public d'être venus et d'avoir participé à cet important événement. Merci encore. Thank you again, John. And as John mentioned, his books are available in the East Lounge, which I believe is in the direction to my left, your right. Ushers will guide you there, and John will be signing the books. We invite you to join all of us in that lounge to meet John and sign by and have the book signed. Je vous souhaite une bonne soirée. Good evening to everyone. Thank you.
Should I go?
Sure. Yeah, all of them.